Welcome back to another episode of the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm Louisa, I'm the host. This episode is all about eating smarter, sleeping better, and boosting mitochondrial health to live a better and more energetic life. I'm joined by Sean Stevenson, author of Eat Smarter and the host of the Model Health Show. In this episode, I learned a lot. Sean and I agree on many things, in particular, the research that he has done when it comes to dehydration and the effects of dehydration on the brain.
And it was published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, revealed that mild dehydration had significant impact on fatigue, mood, reading speed, and mental work capacity in collegiate test subjects. All right, so they found that of all the stuff, like people are looking for these nootropics, but dehydration is the number one cause of daytime fatigue. Number one, right? But we don't want to hear that. We want to get that new supplement. We want to do this thing, that thing. It's water. Water, number one.
I hope you enjoyed this episode, guys. If you do, post it to your Instagram, tag me, tag Sean, or better yet, head on over and leave a written review on iTunes. Welcome to the Neuro Experience Podcast, where you will learn the science of human performance and optimization. This episode is brought to us by Cured. Guys, there is this new morning product that I've just started to include in my stack. It's called Rise from Cured. Rise is a nootropic formulated by Cured's very own in-house clinical herbalist. It contains a blend of lion's mane and cordyceps mushrooms. It's also got rhodiola, ginseng, and broad spectrum CBD. So for a while now, I've been looking for a clean lion's mane product, and this one has been the only one that has shown the benefits both immediately and in the long term. I'm a big fan of lion's mane, and in fact, preclinical studies suggest that lion's mane may reduce inflammation and biological markers of Alzheimer's disease. It's been shown to improve cognition and increase the release of nerve growth factor, which is a protein that can increase the length of nerve cell processes. Right now, Cured is extending an exclusive offer to you, the Neuro Experience listeners. So you can grab Rise for 20% off by visiting curednutrition.com/neuro and use coupon code neuro at checkout. That is curednutrition.com/neuro and use code neuro to save 20% off the Rise formula. This episode is also brought to us by 8Sleep, the world's best sleep fitness technology company. Team, in 1942, the average person slept 7.9 hours per night. Today, the average person sleeps 6 hours and 31 minutes. Sleeping less than 7 hours per night increases your risk of diabetes, depression, weight gain, cancer, and Alzheimer's disease. For these reasons, I choose to optimize my temperature while I sleep, and that is why I sleep on an 8Sleep Pod Pro cover. The pod is the only sleep technology that dynamically cools and heats each side of the bed to maintain the optimal sleeping temperature for what your body needs. With the pod, you can start sleeping as cool as 55 degrees Fahrenheit or as hot as 110 degrees Fahrenheit. 8Sleep conducts research on the effects of their pods, and the data shows that 8Sleep users experience up to 19% increase in recovery, a 32% improvement in sleep quality, and up to 34% more deep sleep. With more deep sleep, I myself can be confident that my mind and my body are moving through the restorative sleep stages that are vital for physical recovery, hormone regulation, and mental clarity. Even better, guys, Eight Sleep has just launched the next generation of the pod. It's the new Pod 3. This enables more accurate sleep and health tracking with double the amount of sensors, delivering you the best sleep experience on earth. You just have to go to 8sleep.com/neuro to learn more. And if you want to start sleeping cool this summer, you can use my coupon code, which is neuro, and save $150 off the pod. 8 Sleep currently ships within the US, Canada, UK, and Australia. That is www.8sleep.com/neuro. Okay, Sean, I want to start with this question. I recently saw a statistic. The US currently ranks highest in overall healthcare expenditure in the world, with a total spending of $3.65 trillion, which equates to 17.8% of its GDP. So where do you think we are going wrong in the medical system here in America?
Some of the best and brightest in the world are my friends and colleagues, and they have the same repetitive story in their traditional education.
Yeah.
They go into the field with the intention of being able to help people to resolve their health issues, you know, chronic diseases and the like. And oftentimes they find themselves in this paradigm where they're stuck in this quantity cycle over quality of time, not even having that much time with the patient to be able to actually identify their root cause. And so what tends to happen is that we bounce to the other side of the spectrum where we start blaming and pointing fingers at our physicians and just like they're, you know, they're just doling out their drug dealers, whatever the case might be, not understanding that when you take a very smart, I mean, some of the smartest people in the world, and you teach them a certain way of thinking, you even teach them potentially the wrong thing, they become world-class at doing and replicating the wrong thing. But it's not the intention to do harm. That's supposed to be the first tenet. Yeah. You know, the Hippocratic Oath, of course, is to do no harm. But we're stuck in this cycle where right now in the United States, ironically, we're the sickest nation in recorded human history. Chronic disease, you know, again, largely self-inflicted. If you look at the data from JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the most prestigious journals in the world, they did a huge meta-analysis. Surprise, surprise, the number one offender contributor to our epidemic rates of chronic disease is poor diet. Smoking is in the mix. Poor diet's number one. All right. And so why is that? That's the question. And I, again, like looking back, would you think that he would have a different answer today? Well, no, the memo, it's not made its way through the university setting yet. Mm. We're changing that. It's starting to happen very rapidly, but we just underwent a very challenging time the past 2 years where people have reverted to their corners again so quickly. There's more divisiveness, but I believe that things are so disrupted that we're in a place where it's more malleable and changeable. But here's the principle and what I was invoking to change my own health, but also, of course, I've had the opportunity to impact the lives of millions of people at this point, which is crazy to say. Millions, that's a lot of people. But just even in a one-on-one context, working in my clinical practice as a nutritionist over the years, here's the tenet. Every single cell of our bodies are made from the food that we eat. Every cell.
That's mind-blowing when you say that.
If we don't get that foundational tenet, I know the top gastroenterologists in the world. They're educated and they go into the field to treat the organ that is responsible for the digestion, assimilation, and elimination of food. Yet they learn about food for less than 1% of their education. All right.
Yes.
And if you like hold them down and ask like how long cumulatively like was your education? I'm like a month of my 10-year education, a month. Mm-hmm. Not understanding, again, the gut lining itself, the liver, the microbiome, the list goes on and on. All of these entities, these cellular entities, even the bacterial cells, they're heavily controlled and literally made from the food that you eat. You're making up these cells. And so I got to share this last little quick one. I know the top cardiologists, all right, again, great friends, brilliant minds. They go to school 10 years, learn how to do different surgeries and stents and all the things, right? Prescribe medications. Again, they're getting in the field to save lives. but they're not educated on the fact that when they're looking at that heart, they're looking at the food that person has eaten or lack thereof. When they're looking at the blood vessels, those blood vessels, the red blood cells, it's all made from food. And if we don't get that cognitively, the ingredients that's making up the thing that you're trying to treat, we're really missing the whole point. And so are we at that point yet? Absolutely not.
Oh,
we're,
hell no.
we're stepping into it a little bit, but
yeah. I think we're years away from that. You know, you speak about something that all I say this all the time on the podcast, and it's got to do with the brain. And I am in constant arguments with my parents' physician. She's, I think she's around 68, 69. And my parents are in Australia, and I take care of pretty much their, you know, medical history, and I help them out a lot. And I constantly fight with their doctor because she, when it comes to the brain, you know how you talk about, well, you know, mainstream medical education, you go to med school, you don't learn about food. And rightfully, you know, in some way, I'm not going to say rightfully so. However, when you look at the course curriculum and you start from scratch and you start from cell biology, and then there is so much to learn that if you start to include food and nutrition and go into depth with it, and then go into neurology and neuroanatomy, because most physicians graduate without really understanding the brain and the nervous system because it's just too much to jam pack. I think that if we are going to move into changing the medical education and changing the way physicians, you know, examine patients, treat and diagnose, then you're looking at maybe an 8-year trajectory of med school.
Yeah. So one of the statistics, it takes on average, unfortunately, again, we're in the information age. All of us have equal opportunity access to the latest peer reviewed data. We just go online and find this stuff out. But actually changing the curriculum in university settings, it's taking somewhere in the ballpark of 15 to 20 years. So everything is so behind still, it's absurd. And one of those tenets you just mentioned, if we're talking about heart health, like I just mentioned my cardiologist friend, if we're talking about this and we're not understanding just how much your brain is controlling the function of your heart, again, we're missing the point. And so we have these people who become specialists, and they're missing out on what's more important, which is integration, right? Yeah. There's actually this new phenomenon. Well, it's not that new, but now it's becoming a little bit more popularized in our lexicon, which is the heart, quote, heart brain, right? And so the human heart itself has all of these factors. And if we're even talking about neurotransmitter activity, very similar to the brain itself. But if we're even talking about something, I'll just throw out a simple thing that's measured today for the average person that goes in for an exam. Blood pressure, right? Blood pressure. Tons of folks today, you know, have high blood pressure. Hypertension is one of the risk factors for heart disease, cardiovascular events, and the like, right? But we're treating a symptom. We're trying to artificially lower or superficially lower that person's blood pressure. Instead of asking what the hell is driving the blood pressure, what's controlling the blood pressure, a lot of that has to do with antidiuretic hormone, which is going to be secreted from your brain and its association with the kidneys. And all of these things that have this relationship to the nervous system and our endocrine system. And that tie-in is happening in the hypothalamus in the brain. I can go on and on and on. And we're trying to treat a symptom or just something super, like lower the salt, right? It's just, it's so... Yeah, it's so rudimentary. And the thing is, both of those things, stress, the question is, how is your body responding to that stress? Because stress is a critical input for survival, for life, for evolution. But it's the balance of those things and your body appropriately handling these situations and understanding, like, even with our blood pressure, it's something that's not static as well, you know? And if we're not understanding all these pieces and coming into it with more patience. And I mentioned this earlier about working in volume, right? Because of the way that things are set up, unfortunately, you don't have the opportunity to actually dig in and find out what is causing this person's hypertension, right? It's very superficial stuff. We see the number, we prescribe a medication, or we give very antiquated advice on diet for the person that largely doesn't work. Again, if you look at the results, and what happens as healthcare practitioners, we tend to think the person is lying if they're not getting the result from what we tell them to do. which oftentimes is the wrong information and or it's not geared towards that person and their unique factors, whether it's their unique metabolic fingerprint, their unique microbial fingerprint, their sleep quality, their life stressors, right? It's not just one thing that's a stressor, it's your overall stress load. Things have to be catered to the person. That's what healing is. You know, if we're talking about this system, it's supposed to be at its foundation about education. Now it's become more parental and it's just not okay. And, you know, that's why we do the work that we do.
We've got trillions of cells, about 30 trillion cells in the...
That's right. Human cells, not to mention the bacteria.
Cells, yeah. Exactly. And to think that everything we put in our mouth soon becomes, you know, what we look like is really scary. And if we were to now discuss every single organ, we'd probably be here for the next, you know, 10 hours. So what I think we should do is let's start with the neuro experience favorite organ, the brain. And I'd love to talk to you about the things that you've found that help the brain thrive. Let's start from what the brain is made of and how we should feed it. And let's talk about the best nutrients for brain health.
Absolutely. This is, it's so cool. You know, it's so fascinating. Michio Kaku, you know, he's a theoretical physicist, largely considered, he's kind of like one of the Einsteins of the day. He said that the human brain is the most complicated organ in the known universe. Right? That is a very powerful statement. What we know about the known universe now is mind-blowing, right? Billions of other galaxies, billions of other galaxies in the quote known universe, not to mention the bigger bulk that is unknown, right? And the human, to say the human brain is the most complicated object in the known universe is quite a statement. And I don't think he says something like that very lightly. And the cool thing is this miraculous, complicated organ. The cool thing is that we all have one of these. We all own one. And there's this personal development tenet that like we only use like 5% of our brain or whatever the case might be, which is that's, you know, this, right? It's not at all true. If there were parts of your brain, recesses of your brain, just like, I'm not doing anything. I quit or I'm not working. We wouldn't cease to exist or we would have severe dysfunction. We use all of our brain, but that's not to say that we use it to its best capacity or we use it efficiently and effectively. And so understanding these really cool foundational things. Now, here's the thing. Again, your brain is literally made from the food that you eat. And your brain is the most metabolically active organ in our body. And I say that with some really eye-opening data to affirm that, which is even though the human brain is only about 2% of our body's mass, it consumes upwards of about 25% of the calories we consume. All right. It is a ravenous organ, constantly consuming energy because it's the governor, it's governing so much about what's happening with our biology. And so just understanding that, but here's the thing too. Your brain is very, very picky. Unlike your liver, unlike, you know, even your heart, there's a very specific diet or nutrient cascade that can actually make its way into the human brain. And this is largely because we have this built-in security system that the brain has called the blood-brain barrier.
I call it the bouncer of a club. It tells you who can come into the club and who can't.
Exactly. You know, I use a toll booth bouncer, right? So there's all these toll booths that nutrients can pass through if they got a speed pass. Or if you don't have a pass, you don't have the cash. But those bouncers are like Dwayne the Rock Johnson, Vin Diesel. Like they're very, you know, powerful in keeping you from getting in there, right? Now, this is all amazing. That's one aspect. We're talking about internal intrusions, but also external intrusions. The human brain is the only organ that's fully encased in hard bone, right? This complicated organ is also the most fragile organ. Our brain is the consistency of like soft butter. Like you can mush your brain so easily, but nature's coming in. And the part, and I thought about this recently, like I was walking somewhere and it just hit me like, what the hell? Why would nature, the most complicated organ in the known universe is powerful. Why would it make it so fragile? And it's because it has to be because of neuroplasticity. It's changing and evolving so much, so quickly. It has to remain in this state where it can be so malleable, which is really cool. And so it has these two protective mechanisms. But today, unlike all of our countless, you know, centuries and thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years to get us to this point as humanity, right now, in the last few decades, we have more environmental intrusions and internal intrusions that can damage and degrade the blood-brain barrier than we've ever had before. And so now we have some really eye-opening data on the blood-brain barrier getting broken down due to things like excessive sugar or neuroinflammation, which we'll talk about another time. But here's the bottom line.
So just so I'm following and everybody else is, because we like to go really elementary on the podcast. So we've got this blood-brain barrier, and now we, you know, and it's responsible for, you know, allowing some molecules to get in and others not, which protects the brain. But now that BBB is becoming, what, thinner, if you will, or it's just breaking down.
Eroding.
It's becoming eroding. And so now other things can freely pass through it.
Yes. And that is even viruses, right? So even certain viruses are finding their way, tearing down the blood-brain barrier and finding their way into the human brain. All right. So the blood-brain barrier that, again, acts as this express pathway for certain nutrients to get into the brain to rebuild this very ravenous organ. Now stuff that's not supposed to be in there is getting in there. And again, we'll talk about that later in the associated neuroinflammation. But this is where one of the big action steps for today resides, which is we get to largely choose what we're making our brain out of. But we have to be aware of what can actually get into the brain and be utilized by our brain cells. And so the vast majority of the human brain, if we're talking about just the substances that make it up, somewhere in the ballpark of 70 to 80% of the human brain is made of water. All right. So, which is really, if we just take a moment to get that, like people talk about, you know, making sure they drink enough water, you know, hydration, but no, truly your brain that's regulating just about everything about you is mainly made out of water. It is that important, that serious. And also today we're looking for like the next nootropic. But one of these studies, and I cited this in Eat Smarter, this was at the time, it was a brand new study. And it was published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, revealed that mild dehydration had significant impact on fatigue, mood, reading speed, and mental work capacity in collegiate test subjects. All right. So they found that of all the stuff, like people are looking for these nootropics, but dehydration is the number one cause of daytime fatigue. Number one. Right. But we don't want to hear that. We want to get that new supplement. We want to do this thing, that thing. It's water. Water, number one. So that's number one. Number two, if we take a step from that and we talk about the quote dry weight of the brain, next up, the biggest substrate that we have is going to be fats. All right. Dietary fats. So, and proteins are going to be next. So we'll just say 13% fat. If we're saying the brain, you know, it's 80% water, 13% fat, 7, 8% proteins. All right. Little sprinklings of some minerals as well. But this is very rudimentary the way that I'm breaking that down. And so now of these fats, what's going on there? So if I just eat fat, is that going to nourish my brain? No, it does not work like that. Only specific fats can traverse the blood-brain barrier and actually nourish your brain cells. And it's critical. This is one of the most important things. If people just do this one thing and address this one key nutrient or this category of nutrients, they can revolutionize their health in so many ways. And so that one that I'm talking about, the category of fats able to traverse and get into the brain itself, are omega-3 fatty acids, DHA and EPA. All right. These are needed for signal transduction, for making the membranes of the cells themselves, for providing plasticity, and the list goes on and on. Without these key omega-3s, our brain cells are literally just, they're at the mercy of degradation. And so as a matter of fact, a study, this was published in the journal Neurology, one of the top journals in the field. They found that people who had the lowest intake of omega-3s, DHA and EPA had the highest rate of brain shrinkage. All right.
I know. We're obsessed with EPA, DHA here. Like I always say 2 grams in the morning, 2 grams at night. So I'm actually supplementing with 4 grams of EPA DHA on the daily.
Love it. Something so simple, but we're going to get into some minutia with this because it's super important. And I'm going to share this off of my experience in doing the wrong thing. And so what that study found was that under two grams was the highest rate of brain shrinkage specifically. So 2 grams is the bare minimum. That's the barometer. And every opportunity that I get, I'm telling folks, make sure to get at least 2 grams a day in. And so how do we do that? That's the question. For years in my clinical practice, I had people coming in, you know, to make sure to get your chia seeds and flax oil and hemp seeds and hemp seed oil, all these things. The omega-3s, you got to get your omega-3s. That's ALA. That's the plant version of omega-3s. It's not DHA. It's not EPA. And so for people who are doing a vegan or vegetarian protocol, we have to acknowledge this. This is so important. For me, I'm a big proponent of food first, looking at what did our genes evolve with. Very logical tenet to follow, right? That's what got us here, much healthier as a species. And by the way, sometimes it comes up for people, well, we're living longer, right? So all that, whatever, we got all these things going on. Highest rate of obesity ever recorded in human history. 250 million Americans are overweight or obese right now. 130 million Americans almost have diabetes or pre-diabetes. 60% of the American population has some degree of heart disease, skyrocketing rates of autoimmune diseases, upwards of 25 to 50 million folks in the United States have autoimmune conditions. I can go on and on and on and on. We are not doing well at all. And we're dying from largely preventable diseases, but also, again, people say, well, we're living longer, right? This generation currently is the first generation, the generation I'm a part of, who is not going to outlive our predecessors. The data is already indicating that. So every generation, our life expectancy has gone up until now. Now it's reversing. In the information age, in the time when we have so much on paper, technological advancement, we're actually reversing this process. And I'm going to add another caveat there. Not only are we not necessarily living longer, we're really dying longer. Because it's not just the lifespan, it's the health span. So our bodies are degrading. And so with that said, if we get back to this tenet with DHA and EPA and our quality of life, This is so protective for your cognition. It's crazy. And so EnySmart, I went through some peer-reviewed data on these omega-3s improving memory and improving the ability to, you know, problem solve and reaction time and all these cool things that we want and want to maintain. But food first. What have we been eating the longest as a species? Where are we going to find these omega-3s in nature? Fatty fish, very, you know, common idea that's shared, but how are we actually taking advantage of the data? Again, in the journal Neurology, they found that people who eat just one seafood meal per week perform far better on cognitive skills tests and have less brain degeneration. Just one seafood meal per week, all right? 1 to 2 is ideal. From there, we've got grass-fed beef. We've got eggs. We've got, and one of my friends, Dr. Lisa Moscone, she's one of the top folks in this field as well. And I love what she does because she's actually looking at the brain, not just theories, but like, let me go see what happens with these nutrients and look at the results with the brain. And she shared with me years ago that actually it's really fish eggs. So salmon roe, caviar has far more, it can be in the ballpark of 3 times as many omega-3s than in the fish itself. So that's just another thing to add to your mental Rolodex. But what do we do if we're taking on a vegan or vegetarian protocol? The ALA found in things like chia seeds and flax seeds, the human body can convert some of that into DHA and EPA, but you're going to lose at minimum, probably in the ballpark of 75% in the conversion process, probably upwards of like 95%. It depends on your microbiome. It depends on, you know, your genetics, you know, what is your ethnicity, all these other factors. I can go on and on at all these different things and how much you can actually extract. So what do we do? I highly recommend if you're doing a vegan or vegetarian protocol, the next step would be for folks who are doing a vegetarian protocol, depending on where your ethics lie, you might want to look at krill oil, right? Krill is a microscopic shrimp. And the word shrimp can throw us off though. And it's really rich in astaxanthin. So unlike the like yellow color we tend to see, it's red. And astaxanthin is found to be very protective of those omega-3s, which can be very volatile. So krill oil Or at minimum, everybody listening today, if you're doing a vegan or vegetarian protocol, please at minimum get yourself an algae oil. Now, I say that again with a caveat because we don't have a lot of peer-reviewed data on it actually doing what we want it to do, but we know that the DHA and EPA is there. We've measured that. We know that it's there, but most of the clinical trials are using fish oil, and that's where the data is existing, fish oil and food. So we do have some, a body growing body with krill oil, but at minimum, please get yourself an algae oil today.
Okay, so you've mentioned, first of all, we've mentioned dehydration, and we've said that mild dehydration is the number one cause of daytime fatigue, so we must hydrate. And we must hydrate with water and our electrolytes as well. Then we move on to fats, fats that can cross the blood-brain barrier. And we spoke about omega-3s, EPA, DHA, and ALA. But there's one thing that you didn't mention. And this was, you know, I am in the United States. You are too. I come from Australia where things are much fresher. Okay, you know, a lot of my cousins go fishing, we have fresh fish, but I'm finding, you know, we can get to the bottom of this, you and I, or you could tell me, what are we doing when we go to Whole Foods? I'm hearing so many stories. There's farm-raised fish, there's quote-unquote wild caught, and these wild caught salmon look really, really bright orange. So are they injecting them with dye? And regardless, if they are we actually getting the EPA and DHA that we need from these American food stores?
Such a good question. And the data that we do have, yes, wild caught is going to be more abundant in these key nutrients. For many years, there was this belief, for example, even organic, you know, if we're talking about produce, organic versus non-organic, there isn't really any difference nutritionally, but now we know we've got enough data to affirm, yes, you're going to find higher levels of calcium, higher levels of magnesium. This goes on and on and on. If the food is grown in great soil that has those nutrients, it's logical, but now we've got the data. So, but here's the thing. I just want people to start where they are. We're not talking about perfection here. We're just talking about progress. So rather than eating a fish fillet from McDonald's, get the farm-raised fish from Whole Foods.
Okay. Yeah.
and get the omega-3s that you can get and the much higher quality nutrients versus that stuff. All right. That's for me. These things become barriers of entry. Yes, there's a good, better, best scenario here, but the most important thing is eating real food, you know, to the best of our ability. And then we can improve from there, you know, because also, as the market demands these things, things have shifted. But there was a time when this was even more complex. You know, if you're looking for, quote, grass-fed, you know, grass-fed, because, and I said, quote, because there's like grass-fed grass-finished, there's grass-fed grain-finished, there's grain-fed, you know, there's this whole spectrum here. And, you know, again, we do know that you're going to have more access to these key nutrients when you're eating food that is, you know, it's not, here's the tenet. It's not you are what you eat. It's you are what you eat ate. Right. And so if you're feeding, for example, you got farm raised fish and they're eating some soy, you know, and cornmeal or whatever the hell, they're going to be making their tissues out of abnormal things for those fishies. All right. But are those fishies going to be better than fish sticks from, you know, the local crappy grocery store? Yes. Yes. However, once we can access better, then we go for that.
Wonderful. Okay. So you did mention a third thing, or am I just thinking that? So you said hydration, fats,
proteins
as well. So yeah.
You know, something else that folks might not hear much about is it's not just the omega-3s. It's these kind of building blocks, right? Some of the things that they help to make. And one of those, well, there's a couple, I'll throw one out, is phospholipids. Phospholipids are so freaking important for cognitive performance. So there is a randomized placebo-controlled trial that I outlined in Eat Smarter, and it found that folks who consumed adequate amounts of phospholipids had increased levels of focus, increased attention span, improved reaction time. And the study also reported that the test subjects who included more phospholipids in their diet had lower rates of anxiety and higher levels of mental energy. So where are we going to find these phospholipids? eggs. And the egg yolk is a star when it comes to phospholipids and omega-3s in general. But again, salmon roe, crab meat, salmon itself. We will find some in some plants like oats, sunflower seeds. But again, you got to look at the quality as well. Mm. So there's an array, but I don't think a lot of folks have their eye on phospholipids. But we got a growing body of data, already a lot of data, but phospholipids are one of those key fats that I think another distinction people can make today is there's a difference between the fats that our bodies actually have on our frame. So we've got like storage fats, right? So if we're talking about our quote fat cells that can hold energy, but your brain is not using storage fats. If it did, then during times of famine, your brain would eat itself. All right. The human brain is largely made of, almost all of the fats that it's made of are known as structural fats. So these are fats used to actually make the brain structure itself. So the brain shrinkage is simply a result of not giving your body the building blocks to make it. It's not that your brain is eating itself, if that makes sense. So we need to have our eye on bringing in these structural fats. These omega-3s are the key. Phospholipids, there's sphingolipids. Cholesterol is another one of them, by the way. The human brain is the most concentrated area of cholesterol in the human body. And your brain actually makes the cholesterol for the most part, but you have to provide those building blocks for that, you know? And so, yeah. So hopefully those are, it's the most important if we're talking about hydration and these structural fats.
All right. So what about nutrients per se? I've heard you speak about magnesium and how magnesium can help reverse brain aging. You also had a wonderful study in your book, and I love magnesium because I don't know the statistics, but most of U.S. adults are magnesium deficient. And the other reason why I like it is because one of the forms that I have is magnesium L-threonate. I actually have two forms. I have citrate and malate. And then at night, my bedtime is 10 p.m. So at around 9:30, I have three magnesium L-threonates because I believe that this is the one that passes the blood-brain barrier and actually calms you down and puts you in a more peaceful state at night. So let's talk about magnesium.
Absolutely. So this was another, I love talking with you because you're bringing up stuff that I haven't thought about in years. When I was in my conventional, I went to this, you know, expensive private university in Missouri and got miseducated. I paid to be miseducated. My professor in my nutritional science class, the first day of school, he was going on about these very rudimentary principles, right? If you want to manage your health, just manage calories, for example. He was overweight. Again, like I don't mention these things often, but he's telling us this tenet that's not working for him. And he's a brilliant guy, but something is off here. And he was telling us about this food pyramid, right? But one of the things that he said also, of course, is like, yes, we got to make sure that we're getting our, quote, vitamins and minerals. And I'm putting that in quotes because it's so simplistic that it can be that you can end up missing the point. And so what do I mean by that? There isn't just one thing. When he's saying making sure you get your RDA of vitamin C, there isn't one form of vitamin C. There's multiple forms. There isn't one form of magnesium. There isn't one form of B vitamins. There isn't, which most people know that, but even B12, just take one of the B vitamins. There's multiple forms of it. So what form do I need? What form am I getting? Especially from these synthetic versions, which is what's propagated. Make sure you take a multivitamin. Right? Mm-hmm. Is that the form of that nutrient that my body can actually use? And if we're looking at the results of people taking multivitamins in our culture, is it helping? Largely, it's not doing very much because, again, we're severely sick society. And of course, like any supplement isn't going to save you versus the pounds and pounds and pounds of foods that we're consuming. And so with that said, with magnesium, just we'll do an umbrella here, but one study, this was a double-blind placebo-controlled study. This was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, and they were looking at the effects of magnesium intake with folks in the age bracket of 50 to 70, so of advanced age in this study. And what they found was that by simply improving and actually testing to see if they're improving their magnesium levels, by improving their magnesium levels, adult test subjects could potentially reverse the aging of their brain by over 9 years. All right. So objectively looking at their brain form and function, their brain became younger by simply improving their magnesium levels. All right. Double blind placebo controlled study. All right. Our gold standard. Another study, this was published in the journal Neuron, found that magnesium is able to restore critical brain plasticity. All right. And improve cognitive function. Brain plasticity, we mentioned that a little bit earlier, is the ability of the brain to adapt and to change. So these are all hallmarks of healthy brain aging or healthy aging period. We want to stay fluid. Aging, disease and breakdown and risk dramatically increases when we become more rigid, right? As a species, as a human unit. So if that makes sense. So yeah, magnesium is one of those key electrolytes, and this is the big umbrella to put it under. It's in this category of electrolytes, all right?
Yes.
I cannot state this enough. Number one for me, and this is just where I'm at right now, after being in this field for, I'm almost at my 20-year anniversary, those omega-3s, if we're talking about cognitive function, and right under that, electrolytes. These are minerals that carry an electric charge. What is the brain is running largely on this electrical currency, right? And so to have that signal transduction for your brain cells, your nervous system to be able to talk to itself, we have to have these electrolytes available. But not just the brain, this sodium potassium pump is really required for all cellular metabolism or all cellular processes, period. Like this has to be present for your mitochondria, for example, to do its job. I was just talking with Dr. Terry Walls recently, and she had a very severe form of multiple sclerosis. She went from being this high-performing physician, teacher, and doing, you know, like cycling and all this stuff to literally degrading to the point that she was wheelchair-bound and just in immense pain and, you know, like just in the state where she was questioning her life, right? And so today now she's out and about, she's doing the cycling, she's out speaking on stages, all these things. And the Walls protocol, you know, one of her tenets that she shared with me involved magnesium. And she was sharing with me, and this was years ago when she first shared this with me, on just how important magnesium was for the functioning of our mitochondria. Like I really didn't put the pieces together yet because I wasn't looking at the, you know, the sodium potassium pump and the electrolyte role just in cellular functioning, period. But now I really get it. It took some time for it to set in. And it just makes logical sense once you understand magnesium is required for like 650 biochemical processes that we're aware of. Like if you're deficient in magnesium, like that's like 650 things your body can't do or can't do efficiently. Like the human body finds a way, right? But oftentimes at the mercy of efficiency, right? And also disease manifestation, that's what we see as a result of simply having these key nutrient deficiencies. So last part here is, why does this matter? Magnesium, a big role that it plays, has a lot to do with stress management, you know, and that's a blanket statement as well, but just your body's ability to, you know, even the parasympathetic nervous system, even kind of activating that side. So much of this process must, you know, function of your muscles, the list goes on and on, relaxation of your muscles, it requires magnesium. Here's the rub. Today, we are in such a stressful environment from the environment itself, you know, the toxic nature of the air we're breathing. Right now, we're both indoors. It's cool we're indoors. It is. It's great. We got shelter, the whole thing. But the air quality indoors is like, I don't know, some of the data shows like 20 times worse than the air outside or even in, you know, polluted, what we consider. I'm in LA right now, all right?
Yeah, I'm right in the indoor heart of air. New York City.
Yeah, it's, so we would think the air is going to be worse outside, but really the kind of processed air that we're breathing in indoors, like even that's a stressor. Our stress from the, you know, the diets that we have, our stress from relationship tension and social media and all this, the list goes on and on. Magnesium is getting zapped from your system so quickly. This is why we require for us to be adamant about it. Again, for me, I'm big proponent of food first, but magnesium is one of those places where I often recommend people to supplement.
Okay, so now the question is, which magnesium, Sean? We've got so many at our disposal. Which is the best one? Is it biglycinate? Is that what it is? Malate, citrate?
I really just don't feel that there's the best. Even citrate, like all of these have their place, right? Yep. However, it's really what's best for you and best for you right now, and that could change. You know, I urge people, even if we're going to supplement, I like topical magnesium, by the way, too. You know, I've seen some great results with that. But also, I would still urge people to look for foods that are really rich in magnesium, right? Because there's going to be a spectrum, and also biopotentiators. Yes. Yeah. Cofactors that help with absorption, all these things that we might not be getting through a conventional supplement method. So yeah, green leafy vegetables, avocados, pumpkin seeds, black beans. And not to say I'm not recommending these foods. These are real foods people have eaten for thousands of years. Chocolate is really a remarkable source of magnesium, by the way. Fatty fish is another source. Spirulina, big fan of spirulina. Again, not based on this kind of superfood mantra of recent, but like we've got civilizations who were subsisting using spirulina as one of their main protein sources, right? So like countries from Chad to... And I'm not talking about Chad, like the guy who plays water polo or whatever. I'm talking about the country and then to, you know, the Aztecs, right? Mm-hmm. So spirulina has a long, rich history. And it's like, it's by weight, it's the highest protein, most dense source of protein of any food by weight. 71% protein by weight. Also, again, rich in vitamins and minerals. Rare nutrients like phycocyanin, for example, which there's some data showing that phycocyanin contributes to stem cell genesis. Like really cool stuff you just don't see in a bag of damn potato chips. Like, you know what I mean? It's just like really remarkable.
One thing that I'm really excited to talk to you about is extra virgin olive oil. Now, I'm Greek. My parents were born and raised in Cyprus. So I've literally been brought up on extra virgin olive oil. And I remember being young and my grandmother used to put it on my skin. She used to put it in my hair and we would just, you know, bathe in the stuff. And then, you know, eventually there was this massive study done in an island called Ikeria, it's a Greek island where it's one of those blue zones where they said this is where people are living the longest. And, you know, I know people that are from there. And so that was interesting. And now we've coined this term, the Mediterranean diet. This is the best diet for, you know, healthy aging of the brain and the body. And it's, you know, mainly made up of extra virgin olive oil. So I know you've done some work in there. You've pointed it out in your book. So let's dig into that.
Awesome. I love that story and that experience, you know, right? And so again, looking at what if you have that connection to your lineage, like that brought you to a place where there is such a lower rate of chronic diseases in that culture who are adhering to the foods that they've been eating traditionally. But for me, not having that as a part of my upbringing, my culture, I can come into it not having a dog in the fight. I don't care if olive oil is great for you or not. On the surface, I'm just setting things up by saying that. If corn oil was better, I wouldn't care. If, you know, fill in the blank was better, I'm going off of what the data shows. And so for me, I couldn't believe it. Like, I just couldn't believe some of the benefits that were coming through. And again, peer reviewed some of the most prestigious journals about olive oil. Like it's like, what? How do people not know this? One of those, there was some data that was constructed by researchers at Auburn University, and they were able to find that oleocanthal-rich extra virgin olive oil is able to restore functionality of the blood-brain barrier. It's one of those things that we have access to in the form of food that's able to heal damage to the blood-brain barrier. How the hell? How does it do that?
Yeah.
What is the intelligence there that food substance has and the human and human tissue. Like there's a really remarkable interaction there that we just, now again, looking back traditionally, even the method of getting that food, how do you make olive oil? You crush olives, right? That's what extra virgin means. It's cold processed, all right? Often bottled in dark glass to pay respect to the potentially volatile fats that we're trying to get to keep them safe and protected. Versus what I was marketed to as healthy, my family, when we was trying to get healthy, using vegetable oil, which vegetable oil is, again, it's using, it's health washing. It's using a term, a marketing term that is attributed towards health in our psyche, slapping that on a product that is anything but vegetables. It's not broccoli oil. It's not freaking, asparagus oil. It's corn oil, soy oil, canola oil. None of those are vegetables. These are not vegetables, first of all, in and of itself. But to, these are, you know, highly, again, highly refined seed oil. But if people just take a moment and even go to YouTube and look up a processing of like, how do you make vegetable oil or like canola oil? And you see that process of corn oil being made and you see the what it starts as and the end result, it has to be treated. It looks and smells so disgusting. It has to be treated with coloring agents and deodorizers and all these things. Processed at high heat for those very volatile oils, the amount of oxidation that's taking place there and creating these reactive oxygen species that we're then consuming. Oh my God, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And one of the studies that I mentioned, and I didn't want to dig into this too much, but I had to throw this in there. This was published in the Journal of Inhalation Toxicology. So this is one of the top journals, if not the top journal, looking at the nature of things that we inhale as a species, and not just us, but just the environment period, and what effect does it have on our tissues and our functionality. And they found that just smelling, just inhaling vegetable oil during the process of cooking can damage your DNA.
It must kill you when you see people cooking with it, eating. And this is why I always say that if you are going out for dinner, and I say this to myself, if I'm going out, then I'm at the mercy of what they choose to use to cook their food in, because why would they choose to cook it in olive oil when it's so much more expensive than canola oil or some forms of vegetable oil?
Yeah, that's the risk that we take. But again, by us becoming educated and demanding better, one of the coolest things that I have not mentioned this publicly before, is because, again, the questions that you're asking, the things that you're saying is just bringing it up. There are so many chefs who follow my work, you know, send me messages, and to see that they're getting this education and then imbuing that into the food that they're making is just so special. And that's the power that we have today, because we don't have to wait for the university textbooks to finally change, to get access to this information and to filter it and to have that trickle down into people's real lives, you know, because oftentimes we don't have time to wait around for the next study, because even a peer-reviewed study to come out, again, my friends and colleagues who are working in their particular practice as a physician, because of that workload, they very rarely are staying on top of the data. They just aren't. And so you might have some access to something that can help to normalize, you know, your blood pressure without the side effect that might be seen from, you know, a lisinopril, for example. And because your physician isn't aware of this data, not that they're trying to be nefarious, we don't have time for that. And so this is why it's so important for platforms like this and what you're doing to educate and empower people, but also utilizing science and utilizing things that we can go, we can triple check, we can look into our things ourselves, but also we have to have the audacity to say yes and to experiment and to figure things out. And that's one of the things that unfortunately has been lacking today. I know this because that was me, because I was getting a permission slip that I have this problem and that's just my lot in life. But if your heart is still beating, there's still so much opportunity for things to improve.
I think we need to do another episode based on how a food like a banana becomes your cells, or how a chocolate bar becomes your, so you're saying whatever you put in your mouth, good, bad, saturated in fat or sugar, whatever it is, it goes into the, it goes into your body, and it literally becomes your skin, your heart, your brain.
Every living entity on planet Earth, the things that we're made of, which, again, we have no, part of the reason I think that I'm good at this is I realize how much we don't know, right? And there is a magic, and I'm a scientist, so even me saying that is a little bit tongue in cheek, but our cells are sort of like these like internal David Blaines, like turning external things into human tissue. It's like, it is so far beyond our understanding. And us, and here's the another key is that we don't have that responsibility. We can't do it ourselves. Mm. You know, even having the responsibility, like if you had the responsibility of digesting your food intentionally and assimilating that through your intestinal, you would die. Like we would all drop dead immediately. Like we can't do it. But, and this reminds me of a movie, Lucy. I don't know if you saw this. Yes. With Scarlett Johansson back in the day. She was like, I've gained full control over all my cellular function, whatever. So that's possible. But right now you don't want that kind of responsibility. And to answer that question a little bit, it's not just the food becoming our human tissues. It's also becoming energy substrate. So things that are utilized for energy, what kind of fuel are you burning, right? This process of getting nutrition to the mitochondria, like what's going to happen if there's like Cheeto dust versus like something from a wild caught salmon, like are your mitochondria going to respond the same? And we got data on, no, it's not. It's going to be very different. Mm-hmm. So the running the processes of the human body, that's another aspect of the food. So it's not just everything that we eat becomes human tissue. It also becomes fuel, and it also becomes waste. So there's going to be the component of waste. But when I say that, waste isn't just waste, because a large factor of that process of waste being created is fuel for our microbes, right? So we have, you mentioned 30 trillion human cells. We've got upwards of, 100 trillion bacterial cells. You know, that number tends to sway back and forth, but we have a lot. And if you want to take it even more freaky and weird, we have upwards of like 400 trillion virus particles in and on our bodies as well. You know, the human virome. I can go on and on with this stuff, but we are providing fuel based on the food that we're eating for our microbes, and also what they're making themselves out of. And if we go gene for gene, with all the genes that you carry as a human being right now, if we go gene for gene with all the cells that you have, 99%+ of the genes that you carry are microbial. All right. Wow. And this gets us into this whole conversation about epigenetics. Yeah. And for years, and when I wrote Eat Smarter, I wrote it from the position of making this understanding a approachable, connective part of our lexicon, which is the principle of nutrigenomics and nutrigenetics, which essentially states that every bite of food that we eat changes our genetic expression. And our genetic template, certain nutrients help our bodies to run better than other things, right? So that was imbued into all the pages. I talk about it in some spots, but it's imbued. It was the intention behind it for people to understand just how powerful food is in all areas of our lives.
Oh my God. I know that you are going to change so many lives due to this episode, but guys, rest assured, this man has an incredible platform. Why don't you tell us about where you share all of this wonderful information and where we can find out more about you?
Absolutely. So people can check me out where they're listening to this amazing podcast. They can find my show. It's called The Model Health Show. And I'm on Instagram at Sean Model. So I do some cool stuff over there too.
And we're going to link everything, including the articles that you mentioned. Sean, thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.